Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, we sit down with Louisiana chef John Foles and Chicago chef Rick Tramonto to explore their partnership in the nationally acclaimed new restaurant, Revolution. They lead us on a virtual tour of the opulent dining rooms and state-of-the-art kitchens, and then reveal what could be coming next in their Home on the Range consulting business. Once we've heard the intricate nuances of opening a real restaurant, HBO executive producer Nina Noble and production designer Chester Kaczynski give us the lowdown on why those Treme kitchen sets look so real. We're getting a behind-the-scenes look at restaurants, both real and fictional, on this week's Louisiana Eats. Louisiana's John Foles and Chicago chef Rick Tramonto are each legendary chefs in their own right, each with distinct food traditions and flavor profiles that have defined their fame. That's why it was such a head-turner when they first announced a new partnership that has resulted in a game-changing Louisiana restaurant that the entire food world is proclaiming one of the most significant restaurant openings of 2012. Chefs, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having us.
Well, that was a great, great, great introduction. We appreciate that.
Well, every single word's the truth. So let's begin at the beginning. How did this partnership come about?
Let me see. It was probably 15 years ago. I was cooking at True in Chicago, and we would have a series of chef and wine dinners, and you know, we wanted to do a cheesemaker dinner with chefs, and we all were trying to find cheesemakers to pair up with. And I wanted a cheesemaker that was a chef. And searching, and there wasn't a lot of them. And the one that came up that was the most exciting was a guy named Chef John Foles.
So he's pretty exciting.
He was pretty exciting 15 years ago, as he is now. So I give him a call and thought, you know, just a stab in the dark. Said, would you come to Chicago and do a dinner at True with us? And he said, yeah, I'd love to do that. So he came and we cooked and we became friends, and our love for food and people were certainly magic together. And the rest is history, as they say.
Now, that meeting 15 years ago is, of course, 20th century news. So take us into the 21st century with what has happened since.
Well, I remember sitting at my kitchen table with my wife one morning in Chicago watching Katrina unfold, to be honest with you. And my wife said, you need to call John. You need to see how he's doing. And I pick up the phone. I said, hey, John, how are you? I see things here. You know, he says, not good. I said, well, what do you need? What can I do to help? He goes, I need you to come down here and help me feed people and cook. And we're going to do a lot of feeding for the rescue workers and FEMA and pray with people. And I said, I'm in. Get me down there. So he got me down, and I was down there for about 3 weeks cooking with him and just loving on people and praying and doing what we could do and doing our part. And going back to Chicago, you know, it just wasn't the same. I've never been in war or in a foxhole, but it was certainly the closest I had ever gotten to that. And 5 years later, actually, is when we found our partnership and our niche and decided to do Home on the Range and do a restaurant development company together. And Revolution was our first project.
So who made the proposal in this new marriage?
It was a weekend of riding around. I call Rick to do a dinner in Baton Rouge every year called Dining by Design. And I called Rick to ask if he would be one of my celebrity chefs at the dinner. And Rick said, well, I have a lot of things going, and one thing led to another. And I could just sense that that, you know, we should probably talk, you know. So I called Rick and I said, are you okay? And he said, yeah, I'm okay. He said, I said, why don't you come down and see me? And he said, okay, I will. And so he came down, and I knew him well enough to know that he was thinking about something. And he said, you know, I'm at the point in my life where I'm trying to figure out my next half. I've done all I can do working for somebody else. I really want to do something for myself, but I don't know where to get started. I said, well, come down and talk to me. And we spent a weekend together, just not mentioning that, but just to kind of see where our heads were. And then Rick said, I'd really like to do something. And I said, I think I might have something. And it was at that point that he and I started to talk about a partnership. We had never dreamed of a partnership, but that was the beginning of it all. And here we are today.
What I think a lot of people, other than perhaps insider industry people, don't know is that this project really is about so much more than the new restaurant revolution. Talk to us a little bit about the greater project, Home on the Range.
Well, we knew we didn't want to do just a single one restaurant deal. We knew that we wanted, if we were going to come together to form a company, it had to be a company that had legs, and it had to be a company that would find its niche where restaurateurs and hoteliers or real estate developers had magnificent properties in wonderful spaces that may have had restaurants operating but yet couldn't profitably operate. We knew that there was a need for a company like ours where Rick and I could bring our talents of management, culinary, marketing to the table to help organizations change over into something that they really wanted to be, and we could conceptualize that within our own organization. So Home on the Range is a company that works hand in hand with development companies or with real estate companies that have a need for reconceptualizing their space. The hotel was a great example of it. The Royal Sonesta was in a beautiful location. It had a great restaurant, Bigay's, and it was just time for them to make a change, and they didn't want to make just a restaurant change. They wanted to do something that was that would really be exciting for the city, exciting for them. We came together because the Sonesta needed us, and we needed the Sonesta, and it's a beautiful marriage, to say the least.
Well, it is a beautiful marriage, and I'm really curious because I lost track of time. So when we talk about concept and conception, how long did it take from conception to the birth of this baby?
2 years. I mean, when we first, you know, had that initial conversation, there was going to be probably an 18-month incubation, you know, really kind of developing the concept and doing the R&D and literally moving to Gonzales and going to Donaldsonville and working out of Bittersweet Plantation, John's plantation home there, and being in the culture. That was the main thing I said to John. I said, if we're going to do this, I said, I really need to spend a year in the swamps with you and understand where he grew up and understand the swamp floor pantry, as he calls it, and really kind of break out the Seven Nations. And it was almost like doing a movie. Storyboards. We did, you know, the Seven Nations. We put everything on a storyboard. We kind of worked through it and understood what each nation brought to Louisiana and why. You know, that was 3 months, and going out and going frogging and going gigging and really kind of getting into the swamps and understanding where this all comes from and the story, the backstories behind it, then start cooking. Like, it took 3-4 months before we even picked up a knife, you know, because we wanted to gather it all. And then the next couple of months was learning how John made a roux, how John made a turtle soup, how John, then I had to filter it through my brain and go, okay, now how am I going to interpret that? How am I going to spit that back out?
Well, anybody who has been to Revolution, one of the things that overwhelms you is the incredible detail that was paid to each single element of putting it together, from the kitchen design to the restaurant tableware. And that's before we even get to the menu. So how'd y'all divide up the work? Was somebody a stronger voice than the other? Did either of you ever have to give the hard sell on a thought to anybody?
Well, I think we had a really good division, but yet at the same time, we collaborated wonderfully because, I mean, Rick took the project of laying out the kitchen and getting that all done. And I started to work with Bill Johnson, who had done two or three restaurants with Rick already from Atlanta, one of the top architects in the United States, built over 600 of the top restaurants of the world. I mean, this guy's phenomenal. And working jointly where we were kind of in parallel with each other and then stopping long enough for me to go into the kitchen and Rick to come into the dining room, the result is revolution. I mean, it was a great collaboration, and it's a free-for-all in there every night, which is unlike most restaurants.
I like the word thoughtfulness. Everybody says, you know, the great takeaway for me every night when I'm in the dining room is that I can't believe how thoughtful everything was. You really thought through whether it's how you designed garmage or how you thought about a purse stool for the ladies, how you looked at your wine cellar or how you looked at the indigo ink in the bar. I mean, everything had a thought process, and that was the labor of love. That's why there wasn't a lot of disagreements, because I was being schooled on the history and I was bringing my contemporary ideas to the table. And, you know, it was easy to kind of, I don't want to use the word give in, but it was easy to continue to accept each other's thoughts, because they were very thoughtful. There was pain and there was love and there was emotion. It's an emotional driven design, every detail, when you're trying to think of that much detail in costume design or uniforms or all of it. You know, it becomes a movie set.
Come back from a short break. John Foles takes us to Storyville. Restaurant Revolution style, that is. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Part of our show today, chefs John Foles and Rick Tramonto explained what inspired them to create a new partnership, their restaurant consulting business, Home on the Range. As our conversation continues, we get a virtual tour of their first project together, Restaurant Revolution. First, John's favorite room, Storyville, where a depiction of the seven nations that created Louisiana's cuisine are all portrayed in a mural covering three of the dining room's four walls.
Storyville depicts an area of New Orleans that was the red light district many years ago, and named after one of the councilmen, Mr. Story, who decided that he had to tear it down and get rid of all of this filth and greed in this opulent place that was called Storyville. But but Storyville in our particular case is the central dining room of the restaurant, that each wall tells the story of the history and, of course, the evolution of Cajun and Creole cuisine and culture. So on seven corner walls, I mean, as you go around the eight corners of the room, you have one of the different cultures, beginning with the Native Americans and their gift of corn to the French, establishing New Orleans first in the 1680s and then founding the city in the 1720s, all the way around to the Italians arriving in the 1870s. The whole story of the inhabitants and their gifts, their ingredients, their philosophies, their techniques to the city are all on that wall. So we call it Storyville in homage to them, the seven nations that created the Creolas, the mixtures of colors and cultures in Louisiana. It's the room that I find the greatest peace in.
Oh, I love dining in there. Now, let's move to that kitchen that everybody's hearing so much about. Chef Rick, tell me, I know you've had the advantage of designing a lot of really super-duper properties with fancy state-of-the-art kitchens. What's new in the Revolution Kitchen that you've never had before?
Well, the philosophy is, for a chef that has to be in a kitchen 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, is that your environment is everything. So I knew that we didn't have the advantage of having windows. Most kitchens don't have windows, and we were blessed because we had windows in our kitchen that kind of gave some light. You know, you feel like a vampire sometimes. You know, you go in before the sun comes up, you leave when the sun goes down, so it was always dark. So I wanted it to be bright. I wanted it to have some beautiful light. So we did great lighting in the kitchen, to be honest with you, and then we brought in granite counters just to kind of give it that rich home feel. But it's open. It's very airy. So you can stand in many areas of the kitchen. And this is coming full circle to answer your question. What's different is that we really kept it open. We hung the shelves from the ceiling versus having the shelves come up from the equipment. So the drop down shelves, you have eye view of the whole, like a bird's eye view of the whole kitchen. And you can kind of stand in many vantage points as a chef and see your whole kitchen in a snapshot and see what's going on. A private bathroom, private television, put on your own music, and, you know, we'll cook for you.
It's the ultimate chef's table.
It is the ultimate chef's
table. Well, and speaking about your coworkers, the staff, that also I know was a gargantuan project. How did you go about hiring and training them?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, because we have, I mean, if you look at the kitchen alone, has about 40 culinarians in there. And some of them, of course, came from Chicago. Rick had some, had his contacts that he wanted to bring a couple folks in from there. So all in all, I mean, we have well over 100 employees. And of that 100, 80% of them are local. The difference is that there's a lot easier places in the world to work than Revolution, because Revolution is about the history. And so training is just unbelievably important in our era. Very few restaurateurs have had an opportunity to sit their entire staff down for a whole month before we open to train them on the history of Louisiana and its ingredients. Most people just come to work and figure out where your table numbers are and how to properly put the plates down. But to work for a month just training people on who the Native American tribes, what are their contribution, where is filet, what does it come from, where does it come? These kind of things were very, very important, because we were Revolution and we were a restaurant that depended on the Seven Nations and the ingredients they gave us, but we wanted our staff to know that as well. They know they're working in a special place. We know they're special people, and we treat each other that way, and I think the customer is getting it as well very quickly. And that's what we hear all the time, that the staff is so unbelievably knowledgeable in their craft. And we're very proud of that, because that's really what the restaurant is all about.
It's a wonderful, very high service experience. And I'd also like to touch on the menu a little bit, because we can see John Foles hallmarks all over there in revolutionary ways. A turtle soup with stuffed quail eggs like I've never had before. And I have a lot of friends who keep telling me about how they dream daily of the death by gumbo. I guess if you got to go, that stuffed quail in the gumbo is the way to go. Where do we find your hallmarks, Rick, on the food?
Yeah, John, where do we find my hallmarks on the food?
If you look at the menu, I mean, the first thing going to jump out on the menu is Rick Tramado's caviar staircase, right? I mean, people walk in and see it. But the formulation of the menu working out of Bittersweet Plantation was, first of all, to look at the iconic dishes and then have to lay a stuffed flounder on the table and say, okay, we have to have stuffed flounder on the table. Let's look at what it tastes like. What do you stuff it with? And then for Rick to go and digest that stuffed flounder in a way to say, okay, now how are we going to revolutionize it? What are we going to do with it? Going into the kitchen, and Rick says, sit here for a minute and let me bring it back to the table in its finished form. And of course, the Napoleon of stuffed flounder is the result of that collaboration. The turtle soup is the same way. I mean, we made a great turtle soup, but at the end of the day, we tasted every turtle soup in New Orleans. So we pay it proper homage to Louisiana first. Rick put his touch on each one of those dishes, and then it was a free-for-all on the rest of the menu. That's why you find that good Louisiana touch on the menu.
And to try to find that spectrum, you know, one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we weren't doing here is that we weren't doing unapproachable food. We weren't doing, you know, molecular. A lot of people thought at the beginning, oh, you guys are going to do gumbo spuma and you're going to do, you know, all this kind of molecular stuff. And I said, no. We're going to take, you know, and give respect to every single dish. We're going to break it down taking the, you know, it's a big game state. So taking venison and making a venison carpaccio, but finishing with dried fruits and nuts because that's what the deer eat, you know, and that's what, and then, you know, kind of putting my twist on it and saying, well, let's bring in some coffee element or some chocolate element and let's roll it in cocoa and let's sear it and let's slice it super thin to bring in some of the bitter notes. So it's layering. And I'm great at that. I'm great at the presentation piece. I'm great at layering, but it was still taking all the history and the iconic dishes and keeping true and staying true to them. But also, I wanted it to be approachable on a weekly basis. That was the key. We're not a special occasion restaurant. We could be, that could be your date night with your wife on Saturday, but certainly the folks in the quarter can come twice a week and graze and eat charcuterie and sit at the bar and have a great glass of wine or a glass of champagne with some burrata and tomatoes and things like that. So we reach a lot of different folks.
So what comes next?
Poor boy shops.
Well, my dream is to open the greatest poor boy shop right in the middle of Chicago, right? And just kill them. In fact, as I've taken Rick to about three or four of the old haunts in town, I say we need one just like this in Chicago because I guarantee you we could make as much money in Chicago in a great New Orleans poor boy shop with 20 taps of beer, the televisions watching football games. I said Chicago needs a great poor boy shop. But anyway, we kid about things like that. But we talk about opportunities all the time. The good news is opportunities are coming our way all the time. We have to be very respectful to the investment that Sonesta has made for us. And Raul Sonesta and Al Gross has done, president of Sonesta, has done a magnificent job for us. We want to make sure that we our commitment is fulfilled. And then we're going to start very slowly looking at our next opportunity. I mean, we certainly want to have a cadre of great restaurants under the False Tomato brand. And there's no reason for us not to have those. And we're working very strategically and slowly to make sure that every one of them is in itself another revolution. We don't want it to be anything less, and we want every one of them to be different, and we want them to be exciting, and we want our brand to start to grow where when people see that sign, they're going to come on in because they know what the expectation is.
Something exciting.
Something
for
exciting.
Sure.
Very, very right.
Thank you so much for coming to the studio for this wonderful visit and a glimpse into Restaurant Revolution.
Good. Thank you so much. Good.
Chefs John Fulce and Rick Tremonto, home on the range, and now at Restaurant Revolution in the Royal Sonesta. And now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, what is the native green and white striped gourd with the taste of sweet potato that is our Louisiana pumpkin, is the couscous. You can find the big crookneck striped gourd at some local farmers markets. The flesh is bright orange and can be eaten sweet or savory. It's delicious in a pie. But they're so scarce that the couscous was officially classified as endangered by the International Slow Food Movement and boarded onto their virtual Noah's Ark, the Slow Food Ark of Taste. Now let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
Well, this week's winner might not be a resident of Louisiana, but he sure knows his Cajun and Creole cooking. In fact, our winner is one of the Culinary Quiz's most frequent participants and is now claiming his second prize from our program. So congratulations to David J. Hubble of Mobile, Alabama, for winning this week's contest, and we hope you'll follow his example by sending in your answer this coming week.
Our lucky winner will be receiving three full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what traditional cooking vessel is such an important part of our Louisiana culture that it has its own annual festival? Send your answers to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what traditional cooking vessel is such an important part of our Louisiana culture that it has its own annual festival? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line. And you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Food critic and public radio contributor Ian McNulty is also the author of Louisiana Rambles, a must-have guide for traveling our delectable state. Ian, welcome back, and where are we rambling to today?
Hey, Poppy, glad to be back. You know, today the search for just good Louisiana food takes us to Baton Rouge and to a particular stretch of Baton Rouge known as Scenic Highway. Now, if you've ever traveled on Scenic Highway in Baton Rouge, you know it's not much of a highway, and it's not particularly scenic either. It's just a sort of a little part of town in the shadow of the state capitol over there. Really, just the refineries are very close by. It's kind of a shadow of its former self along Scenic Highway right now. But I always try to make a detour to visit Belew's, which is on Scenic Highway there. And to me, just like this great pit stop there for good food. It's
Belew's. Now, you better spell that for us.
Yes, it's B-E-L-L-U-E apostrophe S. It's named for its owner, Rip Belew. It's helpful to look for the welding shop, also called Belew's, next door.
And this is
not a coincidence. The owner of this place, the story goes, he was a Baton Rouge police officer for more than 30 years. And on the side, he had a little welding shop. Well, also on the side, he was a great hobbyist cook, especially with barbecuing and smoking and just all these Louisiana traditional ways of cooking. And at the welding shop, they would get cooking and, testing out their recipes on the side over there and serving it to some customers. And, well, the cooking totally overtook the welding and the smoker making business. That's still going on, of course, next door. But now Belew's is like become this great little destination for good eats right there. You walk in, this is a kind of a plate lunch kind of place. You know, it's you order at the counter. They got a steam table with over a dozen side items. You know, you get your plate lunch and your two sides, just heaving plates of food. Quantity is one thing, but the quality is really here too. You're looking at dishes like Cornish hen stuffed with rice dressing, that sticky, dark, peppery goodness of rice dressing all in there. Lots of things are smoked. You can get like a smoked pork chop, or one of my favorites, a smoked ribeye, and even deer and chicken sauce piquant. Doesn't that sound good?
That sounds great.
Yeah, really good, especially when the weather starts getting just a little bit crisp there. You know, that just gamey, peppery sauce piquant, really, really nice. And the holiday is sort of on the horizon. I got to call out one of their specialties, of course, is the turducken.
Of course.
I know not necessarily your favorite dish in the canon of Louisiana cooking, but they do turduckens year-round. Of course, they do a lot of them around the holidays. Fried turkeys, smoked turkeys, all those kind of Louisiana holiday traditions.
So you can order food to go in like big quantities,
yeah,
too.
That's right. Yeah, it's a plate lunch place if you're just walking in, but there's a big freezer section. You can get these vacuum packs, things of gumbo and roux and etouffee and sauce piquants and you know, everything from fried boudin balls to some of their, you know, stuffed chickens and stuffed Cornish hens. Of course, you place your order in advance for those big holiday types of things. Now, Belew's, from that humble start as the restaurant next to the welding shop on Not-So-Scenic Highway in Baton Rouge, it's grown. And, a few years back, they opened a second one, the family did, also in Baton Rouge on Jefferson Highway.
Oh, well, that's a lot more Tony and upscale.
Yes, definitely is. Definitely, if you've gone to the Whole Foods over there in Baton Rouge, you've probably passed by Belew's. Well, if you've ever wondered, same place, same family. Definitely worth stopping in for some food like this. And also, on the way from Baton Rouge to, if you're heading towards St. Francisville, there's a Belew's right there on Highway 61. That's their third one, and that's a little different. That's more of sort of a walk-up stand, you know. So that's Belews. And again, if you missed it the first time, if you're trying to look it up, it's not an intuitive spelling. It's a Louisiana spelling, and that's B-E-L-L-U-E apostrophe S. Really cool place to know about if you're in the mood for just really hearty, rich, peppery, not so light Louisiana cooking in the Baton Rouge area.
Thank you, Ian. Please ramble back and see us soon.
Absolutely.
Ian McNulty, Louisiana Eats Ramblin' Reporter. After the next short break, HBO's executive producer Nina Noble and production designer Chester Kaczynski give us the lowdown on why the restaurant kitchen sets in the series Tremé look so real. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I'm on my Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is a New Orleans native whose writing career began with a Times-Picayune column that ran three times weekly from 1995 until 2009. In 1996, our culinary heritage hero chronicled the stories of the previously uncelebrated African-American pitmasters in his book, Smokestack Lightning. He went on to further preserve the legacy of Southern barbecue in the documentary film that he wrote and co-produced, Smokestack Lightning, A Day in the Life of Barbecue.
You know, what happens is that there are several foods that you can get from coast to coast, fried chicken, hamburgers, hot dogs, pizza. But with few exceptions, people don't argue about whether or not Arizona hot dogs are different or better than Florida hot dogs, or fried chicken in Tennessee is different or better than fried chicken in Texas. Barbecue, you have all of these regional specialties that don't even correspond with state lines. It really can even be subcultures within states. And so in that way, all of us, depending on our region, our ethnicity, our background, our experience, bring something of ourselves to barbecue.
Working with award-winning director Don Logsdon, he wrote and co-produced the PBS documentary Faubourg Tremé, The Untold Story of Black New Orleans. So it was no coincidence that his work caught the eye of David Simon, creator and producer of the HBO series Tremé. Our hero became script editor for the series and has had a big hand in making sure that the food and culture of Louisiana are accurately portrayed in each episode, a feat that has been rarely accomplished in episodic TV.
I need to be careful because these guys, David Simon and Eric Overmeyer, are real students of New Orleans, even without my participation in the show. But a lot of what I was doing was trying to do differently some of the mistakes other shows have made. So the hope was to have a chef who really embodied much of what was happening in terms of food here in post-Katrina. But there's also this idea about trying to have this restaurant be the center of a kind of activity, much as the great restaurants here are.
That's why Lola's Eric Eli is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Congratulations to you, Lola's, and thank you for ensuring that all the food on HBO's Tremé is authentic Louisiana eat. Restaurants, both real and fictional, have figured so broadly in the HBO series Tremé that they've almost become characters in their own right. Treme's executive producer Nina Noble and production designer Chester Kaczynski are largely responsible for the authentic depiction of the New York and New Orleans restaurants populated by Treme's characters. Nina and Chester, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start with a look back to last season when fictional chef Jeanette Desitel goes to work for David Chang at his New York restaurant, Momofuku. David said the set was so authentic that he had a freaky out-of-body experience when he was there. So how did you nail that so perfectly?
Well, season two, I think, started with the Tale of Three Restaurants. We had the feeling that Jeanette, we wanted to show what happens when she had to go back to work in New York. She lost her restaurant here, of course, and which happened to a lot of chefs where they had a lot of customers, but it was just hard to get the resources and, you know, just hard to make a go of it after the storm. And so she goes up to New York, and we had this idea of having her go through a series of different restaurant experiences. And the idea was for us to build two fictitious restaurants and for the middle one to be the real Le Bernardin, working for Chef Eric Repair. And Eric very generously and kindly turned his kitchen and his staff over to us on a couple of days, and we actually went up to New York and filmed there.
So that was done on location?
Yes, it was.
But the Momofuku set,
that and Brulard was both yes. Chester's work.
Where was that done?
Well, that was done here on warehouses on the West Bank.
Okay.
Both the interior, the kitchens, and the complete Momofuku set. We call it the Lucky Peach.
Lucky Peach, yes. Which is the translation of Momofuku.
Yeah. And it was the same, but was slightly tweaked a little bit. So because we found out that Momofuku wasn't open at the time our story took place. So we just played with it a little bit and tweaked it. So when David Chang walked in, it was his restaurant, but there's a few things changed. Color was a little bit different on the wood. There's other little architectural details we changed.
Break down for me, Chester, a little bit about how you would go about creating that restaurant kitchen. It's a working kitchen, right?
Yeah, it's a working kitchen. Basically, the stoves were functioning, so our actors and our extras, who are real sous chefs, could sit there and work and cook. We could fire away and do everything as if they were in a real kitchen. Well, I went with Nina before we started at season two, and we went on this whirlwind tour of all the restaurants. We went to Le Bernardin, we went to Gramercy Tavern, we went to Tom Colicchio's restaurant, David Chang's restaurant, Momofuku Ko, Momofuku Sam.
And the Noodle Bar, the restaurants. We just did a whirlwind tour of New York kitchens just to kind of get an idea of what.
And we took tons of photos, and then you get all kinds of books about restaurants, the layout of restaurants. And David Brisbane had a small little restaurant in New York that worked at Gramercy Tavern, worked at some of the larger restaurants, and kind of told me about the life. It was like being a sous chef there. Mm-hmm. And went to his small restaurant and looked at that. So you do research, and you make it real.
And we wanted there to be a contrast between Patois, which is where we filmed Jeanette's first restaurant, Dix Hotels, which was an intimate neighborhood restaurant where she knew all her customers, and contrast that with the idea of one not being in charge, not being her own place, not being in charge of the cuisine that she cooked or the method of cooking or any of that. And also just a different style of working in New York. We found that they have the open,
it's an island kitchen, as opposed to a line kitchen that some of the restaurants have, most American restaurants have. So we had custom built stoves to make a European style island kitchen, where the chefs work on both sides of the stove.
And who does that custom work for you?
We had a company called South Bend.
Oh,
made
yeah,
it for us,
of course.
A real
major restaurant supply company.
It was pretty. Yeah. It was pretty authentic.
Yeah,
I think most of the chefs were very impressed who came in and toured our kitchen. And Brulard was the first one, which had a very large kitchen. We didn't have a dining room set for that space. We used Mila as our dining room. We started with cooking lessons immediately. When Kim first got the part, the first thing she did was to go over to Susan Spicer's and, you know, get some lessons and also work with Tom Colicchio's people in L.A., at Kraft in L.A., to try to get some cooking skills down, because we learned that just even the simple thing about chopping or even sorting through produce or, you know, whatever it is that we wanted to make those characters authentic for cooks. The people that would watch the show would believe that Brulard is a real place. And so other than Chef Brulard and Dix Hotels and Jacques, everyone else working in there was a working chef.
Had you all worked on anything so food-centric before, or was this a new learning experience?
Not for me, not to this kind of level, this detail. This is the first experience like that. I've done other kitchens, other restaurants, and sometimes other shows you can cheat things. You don't have to be so real and exact, but we did everything to the T. So I wanted the chefs to come in. They would feel comfortable in there. It'd be a real restaurant. They wouldn't see anything out of place, or equipment would be in the proper place, that the space was right, the movement for the chefs was right in the space.
And we had some good intel from consultants. Yeah. I would say, at least with the season 3 kitchen, that Susan Spicer came in and Alon Shaya from Dominica came in. And I thought there was maybe one other person. But anyway, we had people come and tour the set and say, you know, okay, what's wrong with this kitchen and where can we...
And what doesn't seem right? And
just the small details.
And they were very helpful, extremely helpful. They all had a little personal change, slightly differences, because they're a chef and it's very... personally, in terms of how you would sort of lay out the kitchen. But basically, they were all in sync, and they came in and gave some very helpful tips that I might have missed something. But they were all very impressed, and they liked it a lot, this show.
And how long does it take from when you come up with the set design through the build-out and the installation? How long did that take?
I'm turning back how long it took for Days of Tales in the Avenue. Because we stretched it out over a long – so we saw
– We did. For season 3, for Deuce Hotels on the Avenue, we wanted to show what it takes to get a restaurant up and running. So she comes into this raw space and then has to start working and talk about trying to get your liquor license and, you know, just delays in getting equipment in, getting produce, trying to decide what the menu will be. We have her sketching out some of her dishes and working on plating. And, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. So actually, the restaurant doesn't really even open until more than halfway through the season. So it was incremental. On every episode, you would see something else.
Yes,
there'd be
progress.
A little bit. Yeah.
But I'm trying to guess what's maybe the most, 4 or 5 weeks, 4 weeks, because we had limitations on our time to build in this space. So probably just 4 weeks.
I bet there's a lot of people who'd love to have you come redo their home kitchen in that amount of time.
If they don't mind half the things not working, we're fine.
Well, any longtime New Orleanians will remember the site of the Versailles restaurant, which operated out of the Carroll Apartments at St. Charles and Jackson Avenues from 1972 until, I think, 1985. And then there was some sort of cooking school there. I can't really remember the name
of it. Chef's Table, I think.
And then it was the Chef's Table.
Yeah. So what sort of condition did you all find it in when you took it over?
When we took it over, someone said it had been a Chinese buffet restaurant for about 5 years.
It had a big steam table right in the middle of the space.
And there wasn't any access from the kitchen to the dining room, because they could come in from the kitchen to behind the steam table and put the trays of the food. But for our purpose, we need waiters to come and go and our chef to come out of the scene. So we had to open up some doorways to get to access to the kitchen, into the dining room. The kitchen was a sorry state. There was only one bit of equipment. There was a stainless steel prep table there. Yeah. It was – the walls were really yellow and dirty. The ceiling was gross. The floor was really awful.
That sort of Versailles throwback chandelier.
Yes. That was there. And there was these short little pony walls dividing up the space. I guess the previous restaurant had the main entrance coming in from the lobby of the condominium. And we wanted our focus to be from the street. So we had to orientate things differently. We were allowed to take down some of these walls and some of the previous hostess station and just kind of reconfigure it to make it work for us.
The shots are so beautiful with the streetcar going
by. Well, that's what sold us. I was going to say what sold us on that space was just the big window and the streetcars going by. And we imagine that would be – she would feel like that was something, that she had arrived. Then it all fell in Chester's lap to make it work in the space.
So you get the set all ready, and you even designed it down to the tableware and everything. Huh?
Well, I had my decorate team. So he goes out and hunts for a lot of things. He and his buyers, they hunt things down. We bring all samples back. Nee and I looked over a lot of things, from the dishes to the plates, the silverware, the glasses. You have to work out every little detail.
Our feeling was that this should be sort of the opposite of Deuce Hotel's taste. We started with the idea that she's running the kitchen, but her partner and owner, Tim Feeney, is in charge of the front of the house. And that's kind of the price she's had to pay.
Yeah, she keeps having this quizzical look on her face.
And so we our thought, usually Chester and I talk about a lot of ideas and just sort of themes that dovetail with the story. And then he interprets those and comes up with a design. But we talked about a lot of hard edges and a lot of sort of different materials and maybe things that would work, but there was maybe a little too much going on in the space and just a little more corporate, maybe. I mean, if you contrast, we were talking about Patois, how she knew all her customers and she's in the neighborhood. And here, there's probably a lot of people who only dine there once. There's a lot of conventioners and people that are just visitors to the city and not – it's a little more anonymous.
A lot of real restaurants appear in the show as well, real local restaurants like Bayona and Ducky Chase and Toujac's, for instance. So how much fiddling do you do with those locations when
you
shoot
really.
There?
We like to present it as it is. I mean, it's a real place. There's no reason not to. The biggest issue that comes in is the artwork. We have to clear artwork or we have to replace it with other artwork. So sometimes we have to go and do that.
And why is that?
Because we don't get the clearance. You have to have...
We have to have permission.
Permission to show the artwork.
To show the artwork.
If we can't get it from the artist, then we have to replace it with artists we can get permission from. So that's about the extent of what we tweak... Yeah. Basically,
so I guess that Ducky Chase Art Gallery presented a challenge in and of itself.
Yes, it was.
Well, I know that you were very hands-on with a lot of the financials, and this seems like such a huge animal building out a working kitchen, whether you're doing it on the West Bank or whether you're doing it in this space. When you're doing this budgeting, how you figure out the monies, because it just seems like crazy money, you know, for a quick little restaurant that...
Well, but it's a huge part of the story. You know, this was her story, and it was important to get it right. What we did was we recycled a lot of things. That kitchen that went from Brulard to Momofuku to Des Hôtels on the Avenue, that's all that same equipment. And, you know, Chester's team has a lot of tricks. We do a lot of work with scenics and people that can make things look a lot richer and more expensive than they actually are. And we're just clever that way, I guess.
Oh, well, that's because I was really curious then. What happens to all that stuff when you're done with it?
We have a long list of people who want to buy it. There's a lot of chefs that were very envious of what we had.
In tackling this project altogether, what was the hardest part?
Wow. You know, in episodic television, you have a time frame. And so that is one of the elements when you design something you have to take into account. I mean, you have to realize, can I design something that fits the time frame and the budget we have to do it? I mean, those are elements you can't ignore in designing. So that was part of the challenge. But it was to get, I think, get all the details right, to get all the little nuances, all the placement of all the equipment, the furniture, the little sign. We found out that when we were scouting that a lot of the restaurants will post photographs of critics in the back. So when the waiters come back, if you see any of these people, let us know. You know, so they know who they are. And then we just taped up with blue tape. There wasn't nothing fancy. It was just little things like that that I said, oh, that's a nice little detail. That's kind of exciting. You know, I liked it. But I'd never seen that, so it was nice.
I think we got better at it as we went along. In terms of the details, there's a lot of things that aren't in the script. Like there may be one dish that's mentioned in the script, but then you realize that, well, you know, the rest of the kitchen's working too, so what is everybody else making? And we'd start to have food meetings about, you know, what are we going to be serving tonight? And just the background food, and even, you know, when we started Brulard, sometimes we would forget about bread and be like, you know, oh yeah, we need the bread. Okay, you do have to kind of think like a chef in a way, in whatever way we're qualified to do.
Well, that's just fantastic. And I can't tell you all how much so many of us are just loving every delicious bite that you serve us on Sundays. So thank you so much for all of that really great work you've done.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad it looks delicious. That was really our first goal when we started this show, was to be able to make the food taste good on film.
Executive producer Nina Noble and production designer Chester Kaczynski of the HBO series Tremé. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we explore the history of menu design with Tashin book editor Jim Hyman.
There's all kinds of instances of these really, what I find is really great pinup type women. But, you know, again, the suggestion of the nudity and so on is really, like you mentioned, follows all of the decades. So that, you know, sex did play a good part in serving of food throughout the 20th century.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at WWNO.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee, Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightseeking Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh, our editors, Zoe Sullivan and Lane Kaplan-Levinson. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.